Welcome to Risking Enchantment, a podcast about art, beauty, and the Catholic faith, hosted by Rachel Sherlock.
Hello and welcome to Risking Enchantment. For this week's episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Eleanor Burke-Nicholson, who has been on the podcast once before to talk. I think it was Wilkie Collins we talked about the last time you were here.
The Woman in White. Mm-hmm.
So we've taken Wilkie Collins, and for this episode, we're going to move to his good friend, Dickens. I am thrilled to be talking about Dickens. I've been looking for someone to do a Dickens episode with me for the longest time. So when you suggested we could talk about Dickens, I was immediately on it.
Well, and it saddens me that you would have to look so long. Dickens, he really, I'm a deep, deep lover of Dickens and have been for many, many years, and feel as if I have a little bit of a crusade going to make more people love Dickens, because they really ought to.
Oh, I have said this to a friend many times, which is that for being potentially the most famous novelist of all time, he's surprisingly underrated.
I have a theory about that. I think the wrong Dickens novels are taught.
Maybe we should start there, because I think I agree with you, although I think we have slightly different novels that we have in mind, because I've only read a handful of Dickens novels so far. I've been savoring them as I go along. But I have found that Oliver Twist was the one I enjoyed the least so far, and I don't know why it's the one that everyone apparently starts with.
Well, frequently my experience actually hasn't been Oliver Twist. People read Hard Times, which is a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. Terrible idea. It's actually one of his least likable novels. It's so dark and heavy. I mean, just read his social criticism directly and you'll get better Dickens experience there. Or they read Tale of Two Cities. Mm-hmm. Or they read Great Expectations first, which is actually what I did. And I hated it with every fiber of an 11-year-old soul. So, I mean, at that point, I had, of course, been introduced to A Christmas Carol, which is what I think should be the introduction. My mom then persuaded me to read David Copperfield, and I fell madly in love. And years later was able to forgive mm-hmm. Dickens for Great Expectations and even to value it. But I think young people would be better served being introduced by something like David Copperfield, or better yet, the youthful exuberance of Nicholas Nickleby. I have successfully taught Oliver Twist as an intro, as it happens, but I think you need a mm-hmm. lot of support because it's such a dark novel.
Yes. And I feel like one of the reasons people recommend it as one to read early is because there's a child protagonist, but I feel like the child protagonist is such a difficult knife edge to walk, because he's so good and in some ways saccharine, but in this very otherwise dark novel, I just don't think that it's the easiest to access in terms of the kind of emotions at play in there. Whereas, like you said, Nicholas Nickleby is a riot. It's just fun, you know? It's just one adventure after another. And I think, again, because it's so long, people think, oh, well, you shouldn't start there. But I don't feel like you feel the time going by at all when you read that book.
Well, you know, that was the first one that I read with my two eldest children. And the eldest must mm-hmm. have been 9, and the next one was 7. But, and there were parts, I mean, there's a passage in there where Nicholas is traveling by stagecoach and they go all 18th century on you and travelers start swapping stories. That was a little confusing to the girls, mm-hmm. but talking them through, then they were able to attach to the vibrant and exciting characters. They could understand Nicholas as a hero. I mean, from the word go, mm-hmm. because he goes around, you know, pummeling villains. He has so many fistfights in that book. But in a way that's satisfying and attractive, and it's just an exuberant novel. It's a great deal of fun. And it's interesting that you would say that Oliver Twist because of a child protagonist. I wonder if it's more because the villains are so colorful that's who you remember. You mm-hmm. don't really remember Oliver. You remember Fagin. You remember Bill Sykes. You remember the Artful Dodger. And you remember Nancy. But the reason that I haven't used that yet with my children is more because the second one is not ready to negotiate some of the innuendo regarding Nancy. So she's a prostitute, for pity's sake. Mm-hmm. She's a prostitute. So things I don't quite want to discuss with that child yet. But high schoolers, they're fair game. I've taught that one to high schoolers and dragged them through all the redemptive power of violence in that story. Very satisfying.
Well, maybe just as you mentioned there, you were teaching it. I haven't properly introduced you yet. So do you want to talk a little bit about the teaching work you do and as well as the writing work that you do?
Oh, I figured my credentials as a Dickens lover were sufficient, but no, I'm a Dickens addict. But I'm a homeschooling mother of five. I teach high school literature courses for a company called Homeschool Connections. I'm also a novelist. I write in a pseudo-Victorian, early Edwardian mode, mostly in Gothic fiction in that line. So to that end, Dickens has had a tremendous impact on me, not just as a reader, but as a writer. As I said before the podcast, before we started recording, Dickens just really developed my soul as a writer. I'd say Dickens, Austin Woodhouse, Trollope, and Dickens might have been the most influential, which tells you my books tend to be a little long.
No, I love that. I feel like for anyone who loves the actual craft of writing, I feel like Dickens has so much to offer. He's just such a great storyteller in the way that he conjures up the scenes and the people and the ambiance. And so, yeah, I can totally see that. And of course, I've loved your books. I think we've talked a little bit at least about that. Your first one was The Bloody Habit, and then there was Brother Wolf. They were sort of wonderful Gothic novel interpretations. And you've got another book coming out soon, which I'm very excited to see come to fruition. I've been lucky enough to get a little bit of a sneak peek into it already. So I'm very excited for it.
Well, yes, you were extremely helpful with my novel since it's set in Ireland. And you were able to correct me on many things, guide me in my manipulation of Irish folklore. And so, yeah, so no, we're having a lot of fun. So, and the fact that we both love Dickens just seems to solidify our need to talk more often.
100%. So, like I said, I think maybe where to start with Dickens is just why we love it and why it feels like, to me, what Dickens offers all readers, and especially Christian readers, Catholic readers, is this real incredible sense of the vividness of life, that there is just this rich texture to everything that he writes. Like I said, in the scenery, in the background, but especially in the characters. I don't read terribly much modern fiction, but I do feel like there's a retreat into the interior psychology of characters that renders their kind of externals quite flat, or that there's a sort of grey washing to a lot of things. Whereas when I read Dickens, I feel like I'm seeing the world in vivid colors, and that it's all come to life, and that there's all of these strange and wonderful things happening in it. And it just resonates a lot with me. And it just reminds me of the beauty of creation, really. And like humanity is part of that creation, that there's so many different facets and aspects to it.
No, I absolutely agree. And I would add that Dickens, in the vividness, he shows so much of what is psychologically real. At the same time, I mean, we were talking about this before, people will say Dickens is outrageous, Dickens is exaggerated, but Dickens is light. And the interiority that people are trying to capture in modern fiction, which I also don't read much of either, if I can help it, they're doing so much didactic navel gazing. But Dickens, in showing this grand stage, is revealing things about what it means to be human, and always in the light of his very deeply believed in Christianity. He was a Christian with deep conviction, and it was rooted in his sense of the doctrine of the incarnation. God so loved the world that he sent his only son to become man to save the world. And everything in Dickens, his social vision, his understanding of how people interact with each other, flows from that reality. He is not often given credit for how deeply Christian he is.
Yeah. And I think maybe because when you look into Dickens's life, I think he has quite a complicated life with various ins and outs. I think you look at somewhere in like Jane Austen, and she's this sort of upright English lady, and she, you know, she doesn't get married, but she does have a fairly conventional life in a lot of ways. And then you look at Dickens and you're like, this guy's all over the place. I think it can feel a little bit to Christians that, oh, I don't know where this guy stood on everything, or he feels harder to pin down in one particular mode or one particular stock character type, which is, of course, what he would push against anyway. That, like, I feel like as much as people say he writes these sort of one-note characters, I would totally disagree. I think that he's so much more effervescent in the way that he's describing people than just like a single note. I do think he has these characters that have these sort of predominating traits, but that is also kind of true to my experience of life. Like, some people just come across as being very boisterous, or some people come across as being incredibly shy, and there are other parts of their characters too, but that you can see, as Flannery might say, in these sort of like vivid and striking colors, that this is what reality is really like. And so, you know, he wrote life as he lived life, and that was in a more complicated way than you might necessarily immediately understand.
Yes, I think the biggest thing that is a stumbling block for Christians is what Chesterton called the greatest tragedy in all of Dickens, which is the tragedy of his marriage. He was married to Catherine for many, many years, but they separated after 10 children together. And because it was Dickens, it was a somewhat public separation. There are suggestions that he had a very close relationship with an actress. There's no concrete evidence that she was actually his mistress. However, emotionally, there's a connection there that is outside the bounds of Christian understanding of marriage, certainly. And I know my students always have to grapple with that particular point, because Dickens had ideals of marriage and ideals of womanhood, and did not necessarily live in through his marriage experience those in a patient or supportive way at all times. So a little bit of a reality trip for his romantic tendencies in the reality of marriage, that marriage, even happy marriages, are a lot of work. And sometimes your wife doesn't understand you.
Yeah, there is that sense of falling short, which is, we all have ideals that are higher than our own abilities, or at least you hope we have ideals that are higher than our abilities, or else you're not striving for anything. But maybe the idea of the romance is a good place to start, because obviously we're talking there. I mean, I'm sure the listeners of our podcast already know this. When we say romance, we're not just talking about love stories and falling in love and rom-coms and things like that, but about this movement of art and art expression, which is about, it is about intensity of emotion, which includes falling in love, but is not limited to it. It's about that sense of adventure and grandeur and pathetic fallacy, where the world around you, like you said, that there's an externalization to your psychological experience. And so that this is, when we're talking about romance, it's this sort of vivid, deeply felt experience of reality.
And it's also, I think, it's man's desire, man's quest for that greater, that ideal that we were just talking about. So in the end, it becomes man's quest for God, but more immediately, it's man's quest to battle with the dragons in man's life, to save the princess, to win honor and glory. And Dickensian heroes pursue that. They pursue that for good or for ill in various ways.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be quoting Chesterton a good bit. I think we'll probably say, I noted from your own introduction to the Ignatius Press version of David Copperfield, that Chesterton has opinions on the Dickens stories that I don't agree with, but I love reading what he has to say about Dickens. And you can so tell that he did love what Dickens was writing. And so even when I kind of quibble with him, I still love hearing what he had to say. But he has this great description of why, you know, especially as Christians, why romance is actually important to us, because it's actually in some ways what we're talking about when we're talking about religion. So he says that romance is perhaps the highest point of human expression, except indeed religion, to which it is closely allied. Romance resembles religion, especially in this, that it is not only a simplification, but a shortening of existence. Both romance and religion see everything, as it were, foreshortened. They see everything in an abrupt and fantastic perspective, coming to an apex. It is the whole essence of perspective that it comes to a point. Similarly, religion comes to a point, to the point. Thus, religion is always insisting on the shortness of human life, but it does not insist on the shortness of human life as the pessimist insists on it. Pessimism insists on it in order to show that life is valueless. Religion insists on it in order to show that life is frightfully valuable. It is almost horribly valuable. And then he goes on to say, all this in a humble manner is true for romance. Romance is the shortening and sharpening of the human difficulty. where you and I have to vote against a man or write rather feebly against a man or sign illegible petitions against a man, romance does for him what we should really like to see done. It knocks him down. It shortens the slow process of historical justice. And I think that's so perfect because I think we want to talk about some of the heroes of Dickens. And so if we start with Nicholas Nickleby, man, he spends that whole book knocking people down.
Well, and it also, I think it shows the coherence, the narrative that we all desire. We want our lives to mean something. And to mean something, realism would say, oh, we're only going to talk about what actually happens. Actually, if we were going to write a completely realistic novel, it would be things like, I did the laundry. Oh, wait, where's the basket? Oh, wait, where's the, oh, wait, what? Mm-hmm. Oh, I have to change another diaper. But no, it was, what did I actually do in striving to pursue this goal, in this narrative goal? And Nicholas, like you said, is constantly on the move, constantly pursuing a heroic goal, constantly battering villains right and left. It's very satisfying. He hears his sister spoken ill of by a man and he trounces the man before he's even introduced. It's so satisfying. We of course, can't do those sorts of things because they're, I don't know, we'd probably be dragged into the court for assault or something. But very satisfying, very engaging. You never read Nicholas Nickleby and question whether he's the hero.
Right. And I think that's so key in terms of understanding him. And maybe we should say a little bit about Nicholas Nickleby. I am not going to attempt to summarize any of the plots for these novels, because when I say plots, I mean multiple plots within each novel. They're all so wonderfully complex and intertwined that trying to sum them up, you either have to go really banal and like straightforward and be like, Nicholas Nickleby is the story of a young man trying to find his way in the world, striving against his evil uncle. And then like, what else do you say? Or you have to give like a 2-hour lecture on like, okay, and then this subplot comes back in this way. And then these people interact with these people. Like, you might as well just go read the book at that point. So for any of our listeners who haven't read these books, we're going to be talking about three of them in particular, but all three of them essentially follow three young male protagonists and in their Dickensian way coming up against all of the wonderful and amazing characters of London and greater English regions. And if you're interested in those stories, I feel like you don't need that much more to sell you on them. But Nicholas Nickleby is arguably his first real hero. There are several books that have come out before that. Technically, some of them are classed as novels. They're not all quite novels. There's the Pickwick Papers. There's, which is the one after that?
I think Oliver Twist came next, I think. And then Nicholas Nickleby.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the Pickwick Papers is a series of stories that have been put together, essentially. And Oliver Twist is kind of interesting as the story of a young protagonist, but he's not really a hero in the sense that he has to be rescued, but he's not sort of the agent of the story in many ways. Whereas Nicholas, he's an early Dickens character. He's full of youthful exuberance, as he is wont to have. And he is absolutely, definitely the first proper, I think Chesterton calls him like a ceremonial hero, that he has all of the trappings and the look and the actions of a hero. And he has some particularly fantastic moments. There's a scene in which he's been drafted in to teach at this horrible, awful school, which is just the most dreadful place in the world, do the boys' hall. And as we said, he trounces. I don't want to say spoiler alerts. Most of these things are just episodes within many episodes of any story. So they can be spoilers or they cannot be spoilers. They're all just like different moments within these rich tapestries of stories. But yeah, he trounces the master of the school, Mr. Squeers, and it's so satisfying.
Yes, he is. It's right after the very bizarre young daughter of Mr. Squeers has become passionately in love with him. I mean, it's fabulous. I would say there's a distinction too between Nicholas Nickleby and the two other heroes you wanted to discuss today. So Nicholas is of age when the story begins.
Mm.
So it isn't a Bildungsroman. It's not a coming of age novel. He's already of age. He's already equipped. We don't get all of the training, heroic training. We just get launched into the world and that his launch is precipitated by his villainous scheming uncle, and he goes straight into the arms of Mr. Squeers, is just, it's perfect. And that energy doesn't stop. I've already recommended to you, but I will recommend to listeners as well. There's a 9-hour adaptation of Nicholas Nickleby with Roger Rees as Nicholas. It is the best adaptation of Dickens ever. It's all on a stage, and they capture the energy and the voice of Dickens, which is something when you were talking about why we love him, I think has to be mentioned, is that when you read a Dickens novel, Dickens himself is speaking to you so often, and his voice is just so tremendous. You can imagine those moments late in his life when he would give public readings and stand on a stage and read parts of his own novels, which I always love to tell my students. The Bill Sykes and Nancy passage from Oliver Twist, he performed it so intensely women would faint, and biographers believe that this contributed towards his early death because of the amount of energy he put into those performances. And then I make my students read aloud those passages, say, "This could kill you. Let's read it." Imagine Dickens's voice. But you feel his voice coming through in all of this. It's just breathtaking. And in, as I said, that Roger Rees adaptation really captures that element well. The color, the crazy wildness of the interlaced characters, but the Dickensian language is just, I don't know, it leaves me just wilting with just adoration. I adore Dickens. He's just, I don't know why more people don't value him.
I think this is actually, one of my friends who are listening to this will know this. This is something that I say to them often when I'm recommending Dickens, which is either listen to audiobooks or make sure to like read at least chunks of it aloud. Because the other thing that I'm always trying to convince people is that Dickens is terribly funny. And I feel like a lot of people are trained to read books for the plot. And so they're just sort of getting through the content, I don't want to say as quickly as possible, but they're not kind of mulling over each word or each sentence or, you know, taking it all in. And I remember having a discussion with someone about reading A Christmas Carol and saying, "But it's so funny." And them saying, you know, I don't think I noticed that it was funny. And I was like, the first sentence is Marley was dead to begin with. Surely that is a joke opening if you've ever heard one. Yeah. And then it goes on to be like, he was as dead as a doornail. But I don't know why doornails are the deadest piece of ironmongery. For my own sake, I would have said coffin nails are. And there's this whole aside about like whether or not doornails could be like the dead piece of ironmongery. And I'm just like take the time to read it. And it's especially, like you said, in those authorial asides. There's a lot of it in the characters as well, but if you're paying attention to what Dickens is saying in any particular scene, he is often saying something deeply funny. And I think there's so much enjoyment to be gotten out of those books when you take the time to experience that. And as I was saying to you, I have not seen this 9-hour adaptation. I'm clearly missing out. So maybe I'll be revising my opinion. But I often say that that A Muppet Christmas Carol is what I consider to be the best Dickens adaptation, because it has the voice of the character of Dickens. It has Gonzo as Dickens getting to say what are often the best lines of that story. Like, otherwise, who's going to say those lines? So to me, it's perfect to have Dickens in the story of the adaptation, because he's so central to your experience of his storytelling style.
Well, and even the introduction of characters, and I would definitely agree, I am a big fan of Muppet Christmas Carol, but when I mentioned the Roger Rees adaptation, the introduction of Squeers. Squeers has basically one working eye, and Dickens, when he introduces him, makes some snide remark about the oddity of this popular prejudice being in favor of two eyes. Well, when they present the character of Squeers, one of the other characters on the stage is narrating that description. So you can see the actor presenting, but hearing Dickens is giving it the comic twist and really driving home the brilliance of it. But no, I agree. People often miss the comedy. I know when I first read Great Expectations and hated it at age 11, I never would have realized that Dickens himself described it as writing in a tragicomic mode. He thought it was hilarious.
Mm.
Grotesque.
Right.
Hilarious. I could not comprehend that at age 11. Now I can comprehend that and value it. But it took a little while.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of Nicholas Nickleby, I always think there's a joke near the very start of the book. And it's just a very simple joke, but it makes me laugh every time I think about it, which is that he's describing this really decrepit, awful, shriveled courtyard garden. And he describes the trees as being everbrowns as opposed to evergreens. It just cracks me up.
And I think Dickens wants us to pick up on those sorts of jokes. He puts those in because he's finding it funny. You can almost envision Dickens deep mm-hmm. in, you know, the imaginative process, laughing himself to, you know, sick over something he's just written because it's that mm-hmm. hilarious. I think your recommendation about listening to it, especially if you're struggling with the language, can help. A really good mm-hmm. book on tape can let you hear how funny it is, because the performer mm-hmm. will give you that space and make you linger in the language long enough to get it.
Yeah. And I think for Nicholas Nickleby, what's nice about him as a heroic character is that, I don't know if he's totally successful in this, but Dickens himself said that in the character of Nicholas, he was trying to combine a sort of naturalness with a heroicness. And I feel like the heroicness definitely sort of takes over as the story goes on. He becomes much more straightforwardly a hero. But certainly in the early part of the novel, there's, first of all, more of his flaws and more of his, you know, rashness. And he's certainly yearning to be more of a hero than he really is, which means that we get these great scenes that Dickens does of us sort of laughing at him as a hero. Like you already mentioned that the first sort of great love affair of the book is totally unreciprocated on his part. And it's that Fanny Squeers, the daughter of this evil Mr. Squeers, has decided that does she love him, but that he loves her. And he's sort of caught in this, this unwarranted romantic experience that he's trying to extricate himself from. And so we as the readers are totally laughing at this young man who so wants to be a hero and is stuck in these much more mundane scenarios that he's, you know, trying to be the hero of. And I love that so much. I think Chesterton calls him a chivalrous donkey, that like there's that sense at the start that he's yearning and trying to be better than he is. And I think maybe him sort of flogging Mr. Squeers is his first kind of big heroic moment where he gets to have that triumph that so characterizes his story, because he becomes a bit like it's not a coming of age novel, but it is a picaresque novel in the sense that it's like episodic and moving from one thing to the other. And he goes on all of these wanderings and he has all of these successes, like he becomes an actor and then he goes into Parliament reporting. Is that right? And he turns his hand at everything and he assumes all of these new roles and he has these sort of peaks and troughs of fortune, which is really fun. But it all kind of essentially starts at this moment where he cries out, stop, and takes a hold of the situation in the school. And I think to come back to what Chesterton said is about it, which is that he thrashes the schoolmaster within an inch of his life. He throws the schoolmaster away like an old cigar and he goes away. The modern intellect is positively prostrated and flattened by this rapid and romantic way of righting wrongs. If a modern philanthropist came to do the boy's hall, I fear he would not employ the simple, sacred, and truly Christian solution of beating Mr. Squeers with a stick.
Well, and also look, do you see how long it took him to get to that point? Because at first, when he's sort of going about his work at the school, there's Fanny Squeers pursuing him. And at first he doesn't understand. He does a little bit of sulking. But the thing mm-hmm. that falls out of his soul, that heroic response, is that he cannot bear to see Mr. Squeers beat the disabled boy, Smike. And that's also Dickensian, mm-hmm. you know, is the sense of the most downtrodden, and his sense of outrage is just roused. So it's true philanthropy. That's true philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And then bringing Smike with him on his adventures. I was persuading my sister-in-law to read or listen to Nicholas Nickleby with my nephew. And my mother's response was, "Oh dear, how will he handle the trajectory of Smike?" I said, "Oh, I hope it just brings my poor nephew to his knees, weeping the beauty of Smike's part of the story." Because that's an important formative experience, is to be just, mm-hmm. And Dickens has done that to me many, many, many times. This is what I told you before the podcast. Read Dombey and Son. There's another scene there that Dickens. Oh, he pulls at your heartstrings. Yeah. He's so brilliant.
Yeah, he is. And I just think that there's such a sense of satisfaction in terms of reading a hero like Nicholas Nickleby, that he is human. He does have flaws. He's not all powerful by any means. He is certainly struggling against, and especially the fact that he has so many things set against him at various times. And it's so satisfying to see how those resolve, or, you know, to see this righting of wrongs, that I think we underestimate our deep yearning when, as readers and as people who love stories, our deep yearning to see wrongs righted. And I think, you know, we can talk a lot about how things can be more nuanced and you need systemic change and all of these things, but there is just something that our soul yearns for, to see something that's not right and to see the action taken. And I think that's what Nicholas is so good for, is seeing someone, a man of action, that I'm going to go and do this thing and I'm going to respond with action, and I'm not going to sit and think about this or have all of these interior qualms about it, that I'm going to see the right thing to do and act on it. And it really reminds me, like, I feel like he sort of goes through the whole novel like Jesus in the temple with the moneylenders. Like, yes. He's just turning over tables and...
that's a really good comparison. As you were talking, I could see one of the illustrations from the novel, the original illustrations, and there's Nicholas standing bolt upright, pointing an accusing finger at Saul. I don't even remember which scene it is. It could be so many different scenes. It's Nicholas saying, "That's unjust. I shall now challenge you." Actually, I won't challenge you. I'll just floor you. And it's interesting that for this podcast that you were putting Nicholas first, because as you're talking, I'm reflecting how much those qualities are lacking, or how much struggle there is in the formation of those qualities and our two other heroes. This is actually a point where I've heard from people a lot of frustration, if we switch to David Copperfield, that David is naive. David lacks drive and direction. He always does seek to do the next right thing, but he is not a young man who knows how well to be a man. One assumes that Nicholas, formed by his father, has male virtues. David is crippled in the formation of male virtues from the very first page.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you wrote really beautifully about that in your introduction to the Ignatius Press edition. Yeah, I think that's so true, which is that you can so see him as a character who is trying to be good almost in a vacuum, that, like, he keeps searching for good role models. And in contrast to Pip in Great Expectations, who we're going to talk about later, he does recognize and respect the good when he sees it. I think Pip struggles a lot more with that, whereas David does feel like the character who is actually able to recognize the good and tries to strive towards it, even when he just doesn't have the tools. I think it's so interesting what makes David Copperfield special is that it is the most close to Dickens's own experiences and life, and, like, it's vaguely autobiographical. I know in his introduction, he says that David Copperfield is his favorite child. If you have to have a favorite child, that's it for him. And isn't it so interesting that book begins with the question that David says of it's a question of whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life or whether that station will be held by anybody else these pages must show. So the question of who is the hero of this story is actually presented as soon as the novel opens.
Yes, and it bringing back that Dickensian voice, the whole time you're hearing mature David, who's Dickens, mm-hmm. reflecting on young David and seeing young David's struggle and recognizing that young David is born. He's a posthumous child. His father is dead before he's even born. And then he later is saddled with an extremely abusive stepfather. And that he goes through mm-hmm. so many trials and travails and is trying to grow as a hero, but he's as naive and non-action-driven as his poor mother, who is an extremely gullible female. I think that jumping way ahead into the novel, a real moment of interior torment for David is when he realizes that in his early marriage with a very simple wife who's not unlike his mother, he's getting frustrated with her and he starts to come up with a design to try and mature her. And his aunt, his dear aunt, mm-hmm. calls him on it because he's basically following the paradigm of his abusive stepfather. So is that in this moment of desperation, mm-hmm. how can I mature my wife? He's tempted to follow that example. And of course he won't, mm-hmm. but that would be so scarring to him in his youth at such an early age, such an impressionable age, that he would have to work out that trauma throughout his life and figure out what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to strive heroically? Because he has heroic visions. He has heroic ideals. Mm-hmm. And how do I do that? How do I do that? He's, as I said, an extremely naive and gullible young man. I find it lovable, but I know readers who've become frustrated and said, come on, grow up, David. And I feel like psychologically it makes a lot of sense that he takes a very long time to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's so interesting that at the same time that he's writing this book, Dickens is also writing what was a private book, but for his children, called The Life of Our Lord, where he's trying to show them the example that he actually wants them to follow. And he even says in it, "My dear children, I am very anxious that you should know something about the history of Jesus Christ, for everybody ought to know about him. No one ever lived who was so good, so kind, so gentle, and so sorry for all people who did wrong or were in any way ill or miserable as he was." That idea that, like, not only trying to be a better role model for his own children, like be the person that his father wasn't for him, but also to say that even in the places where I fail, that there's something important to show you that there is a role model that everyone can look to in Jesus Christ. And the idea that that's going through his head as he's writing this book, David Copperfield, that is so full of a lack of instruction and a lack of direction, especially in that kind of fatherly or male role of example.
In some ways, it's a more serious consideration of that Dickensian social solution, which is, the virtuous rich care for the virtuous poor. That's Dickens's social solution in most of his novels. But here it's that virtuous men care for the virtuous unfortunate. And it's just a sense that to grow in virtue means never viciously to exploit others. And that is one of the qualities of David that is valuable. There is no vice in David. Mm-hmm. David does not exploit other people. Mm-hmm. He is exploited by other people, and that, I think, is shown in many examples in the novel, but principally perhaps through his first idealized hero, his childhood friend, James Steerforth, who's a scoundrel, who's a very vicious young man, who is selfish, manipulative, deceitful, but that David desires, he sees him as a hero, and he desires him to be a hero, and has to come to terms with that vice that is deep within Steerforth.
Yeah, I think there was an article I was reading that had a very interesting little graph that it did where it put the characters on a different scale. So the character of Ham was the sort of unreal virtue in that, like, so virtuous it's sort of unreal. And then Tommy Traddles is like the practical virtue, and then David's sort of in the middle trying to figure out where he is. And then Steerforth is the attractive vice, and mm-hmm. Uriah Heep, who I think we're going to come back to in a minute, is the repulsive vice. And the idea that, like, we have to reckon with the fact that there are both things. There are attractive people who are full of vice, as well as unattractive people who are full of vice. And I think Dickens, I love the way he writes villains, but I think people think of a lot of his villains only as that sort of unattractive evil, whereas actually the ones that do almost the most damage are these ones that are quite attractive. They're the people that you want to be around until you kind of recognize or grow to have that coming of age that says, just because I had this kind of boyish idol of this person doesn't mean that I can't grow beyond that and see that actually there's something negative here, and in fact something quite evil.
Well, and you know, you're making me think of an early scene in the novel, which will bring us back to schoolmasters. Here it's not Nicholas thrashing Mr. Squeers. It's that Steerforth publicly humiliates Mr. Mell, who's this virtuous non-entity school teacher who's kind to David. But mm-hmm. Steerforth takes a dislike to him, so he publicly shames him and has him thrown out of the school. And young David, as the narrator tells us, shouts, you know, three huzzas with everyone else. They're all cheering, backing up Steerforth, even though the suggestion is there's something not quite right here that David doesn't understand. Clearly the narrator does, sees how wrong Steerforth is. And there's little Tommy Traddles sobbing and saying it wasn't just, it wasn't right. I had an interesting argument with a cousin of mine on the subject of Tommy Traddles, where she said Tommy Traddles is the real hero of the novel because he has a sense of virtue early on. He is driven in that virtue. He pursues it in a very simple, practical way. I said, well, no, he's not the hero of the novel because Tommy Traddles doesn't actually need growth. He's clearly not, because it's not called Tommy Traddles. It's called David Copperfield. But David requires growth. A hero who doesn't grow in some way, even Nicholas has to continue to contend against odds to achieve a goal. I mean, Traddles does pursue a practical goal, but for David, it's really tackling this question of what does it mean to be a hero? What does the hero attain? And how far can I go from being the fatherless or posthumous child to a heroic man and the father of his own children? Because, you know, that's the big thing. In a Victorian novel that ends with marriage and with children means we won. We mean it's a comedy, not a tragedy. And it means the next generation will continue on. This new generation will be able to care for even more of the unfortunate downtrodden. So, you know, at the end of a Dickens novel, we sort of gather in all of the little homeless and unloved, worthy people together, and all of a sudden we've got this irregular but beautiful family circle. That's the goal, and that's what David wants. To that extent, again, I defended David fiercely to my cousin, saying that Tommy Traddles is extremely valuable as a character and recognizes early on that Steerforth, there's something not right. But for David, it's young David has to grow out of that idealized fascination with what a hero might look like, which is his mistaken vision of Steerforth.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. You said it to me that, like, the other sort of villain that I've mentioned here, Uriah Heep, he recognizes that Copperfield is the hero of the story because he sets himself up as the anti-David.
You're always against me, Copperfield. You know, he says all sorts of things. Even the final showdown with Uriah, David doesn't orchestrate any of that. He doesn't kill the dragon. Uriah's the dragon. He doesn't do anything.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Uriah Heep because I think he's so interesting as a villainous character, because especially for Christians and Catholics who are thinking seriously about virtue. And I think the virtue of humility is something that we get wrong a lot. And I count myself in that category. And it's very hard to know what it is to, or how it looks like to live out humility. And I think it's very instructive to show what it isn't, which is what Uriah Heep does, which if anyone knows anything about the character of Uriah Heep, it's that he's constantly saying that I'm so very humble. I'm just such an humble creature. He's always professing his humility. And it's just, I mean, I'm going to read a little bit of it here because the descriptions are so perfect. The young David comes to this lawyer's office and is so kind of taken in by what's happening. And he says, "I suppose you are quite a great lawyer," I said, after looking at him for some time. "Me, Master Copperfield?" said Uriah. "Oh no, I'm a very humble person." It was no fancy of mine about his hands, I observed, for he frequently ground his palms against each other as if to squeeze them dry and warm, besides often wiping them in a stealthy way on his pocket handkerchief. "I am well aware that I am the humblest person going," said Uriah Heep modestly. "Let the other be where he may. My mother is likewise a very humble person. We live in an humble abode." And then as the conversation goes on, you know, David tries to sort of flatter him and says, "Perhaps you'll be a partner in Mr. Wickfield's business one of these days," I said to make myself agreeable. "And it will be Wickfield and Heap, or Heap late Wickfield." "Oh no, Master Copperfield," returned Uriah, shaking his head. "I am much too humble for that." And that constant idea of like, pretending that you don't have more aspirations than you have, to say that, like, "I would never even dream of reaching for such a thing," when in reality, not only are you dreaming of it, but you're taking actions that are nefarious, that are trying to get what you want by subtle and deceitful means. That, you know, it's such a powerful rendering of what that looks like when we're insincere about what we're saying and we're insincere about our own intentions and how we're acting.
Well, and I love the idea that you're presenting it as the demonstration of how not to seek something virtuously. Because, of course, Uriah's goals are similar in some respects to what David would want. David wants financial security, a position in society, and he wants the princess. He wants a happy marital life. Uriah, when he's baffled, because of course he has a deep desire not only to take control of Mr. Wickfield and to destroy his enemies, he wants to annihilate anyone because he's so driven by envy. Envy, the sin that has no consolations in it, because you're eaten alive because you don't want someone else to have any sort of joy. He does not want David to be hero, even though poor David can't even figure out how to be hero. But later, when he's baffled in it and everything's exposed, there's this little line reference to catching Uriah looking at Agnes Wickfield. And it shows the lust and the desire he has for it. It's disgusting. It's so creepy when you really stop. It was one of those things I didn't really pause the audiobook to explore with my daughters. Say, "All right, we'll just keep going. When you're a little older, we'll look at that." And the way that he was just working down on Agnes to gain her. There's even a suggestion in that scene that he would have succeeded if he weren't stopped. That he wants to destroy things that are beautiful and virtuous and good just to correct them so that he can have power over them. It's just fascinating. And again, it seems outrageous, but it is real. It is real. There are people who are evil, and these are sins that do lead to these sorts of behaviors. So Uriah is, well, he also seems to show a real negative feeling about redheads in the Victorian period. There's another character in Anthony Trollope, same thing. Wet palms. Why do they always attribute wet handshakes to redheads? Anyway, that's by the way. But that he's this foil who is more compelling as a foil than poor David is for the first two-thirds of the novel.
Absolutely. And I think what's so threatening about Uriah, and what makes him, to me, actually quite believable, like I think these people exist in the world, is that he has convinced himself of his own perspective. Because I was reading an interesting article by Theodore Dalrymple calling it like the age of Kant, and this idea of Kant as something that is exemplary of our age, which is that he says it's far worse than hypocrisy, because like I was saying with Dickens, hypocrisy is the failure to live up to our professed moral ideals. But Kant is this destructive idea of you deceive yourself as well as others, that you think that you're in the right and you think that you have good motives and you think that you're justified in what you're doing. So you've spoken, it's almost like speaking a spell over yourself that gives you permission to do all of these horrible things because you've twisted the reality to say that you're actually justified in pursuing these ends with these means. And that's what Uriah is this like this self-centered twisting of reality towards his own ends.
In that respect, I think we'd have to say that Uriah is more evil than Steerforth, because Steerforth, it's that, Aquinas speaks about this, that sins of the flesh are more shameful and less grievous than sins of the intellect. And Steerforth's sins rise out of weakness, and he has moments of shame, and he has moments where he does not want David to see how vicious he is. It's one of the things that attracts Steerforth to David, that he's so fresh as a daisy. He's so gullible. That's why he calls him Daisy. You're so gullible. But on the other hand, there are no moments of Uriah questioning himself and saying, I know I'm bad. I know I'm vicious. I know I have, but I'm just going to do it anyway. Uriah doesn't even, as you said, he's completely self-justified. He does not question what he's doing or question himself. So I think he is more evil than Steerforth, and thus less worthy of redemption, or that we would grieve less if he is not granted redemption.
I think that's a good description of it. And I love what you called out about Steerforth calling David Daisy. And I know in your introduction, you had actually a really interesting point about all of the different names that David gets called. And it reminded me of how, because it might bring us actually into Great Expectations. I feel like David Copperfield is in some ways a fairy tale that has a happy ending, whereas the Great Expectations is almost a subversion of a lot of those fairy tale tropes. So in David Copperfield, you have the character of Betsy Trotwood, who comes in like a fairy godmother and gives him a new name and bequeaths him with this entitlement. And, you know, and I think you made the point of all of these different names having different kinds of power over you if you allow people to give you these names, and that being a kind of fairy tale trope. And then you get to Great Expectations, where you have the other fairy godmother of the sort of, that she doesn't bequeath things, but she looks like she's bequeathing things, and that she is giving you this sort of poison chalice instead of anything good in the character of Mrs. Havisham. So there's a lot in Great Expectations, which is the subversion of some of those like little fairy tale tropes that Dickens weaves through his novels.
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. If David Copperfield spends the entire novel negotiating names and trying to make a name for himself, which is one of his goals, make a name. What is my name? Who am I? If I'm the hero, what's my name even? Pip, he starts out Great Expectations, a little 7-year-old boy in a graveyard, which if you read the scene properly is an hysterically funny scene. I did not understand that again when I was 11 years old. And he's sitting there reading the names of his parents and his siblings on gravestones, including he sees his name on a gravestone, you know, so it's seeing his family name, seeing himself, who am I, little boy coming of age, or not coming of age, but coming of age of reason. And this is the moment I'm going to begin my tale. And then what happens? The convict Magwitch comes, takes him, and turns him upside down. So his whole world perspective shifts upside down. And now he doesn't know who he is. He's thoroughly rattled. And yet, even in this thoroughly rattled state, he's still malleable. He can still be formed to an extent. When Miss Havisham comes into his life and he thinks that he now is going to receive a great deal of money, his fortune is made. He doesn't have to make a name for himself. He will be a gentleman. He loses his drive that you see in David still questing. Pip stops questing. He has a sense of entitlement. I have expectations. I don't aside from being dissatisfied with what's in front of me, I don't have to strive anymore. Mm-hmm. When you really think, going back, it'd be better if you were shaken upside down a little bit more to have a little less sense of security mm-hmm. in who he is. Because then he's given a sense of, I'm this, I don't need to work. That's such a debilitating feeling. I see it in a child. If you're teaching a child, I don't have to learn this. I know it. Done. Mm-hmm. You can't teach now. You can't grow. You can't even converse. Or if a child's being disciplined and says, I get it. It's like, well, no, that means you just put up a wall. And Pip, his entire life is behind the wall of that Miss Havisham manipulatively creates.
And I think it's interesting that pretty much the first thing he does when he comes into his a little bit of the money that he's expecting is he becomes a fop. He goes and buys these clothes and is sort of strutting around town and immediately has his pride wounded by a little boy who's making fun of him. And it's such a, you know, an absence of manly virtue. And is instead this, you know, the almost the manly weakness, which is to be this sort of dandy and fop who's immediately insulted and doesn't know how to react and is snubbed and feels all self-conscious. And, you know, it's such a funny scene of him trying to maintain his dignity as he's being constantly laughed at by this little boy that yes. I think it's Trab's boy yes. sort of jeering at him in the street.
And then he even tries to hide from Trab's boy. And it's funny because there's a similar scene in David Copperfield where David goes through a period of a little bit of foppery. But notice that the narrator of David Copperfield can look with affectionate patience at the silliness of David, whereas we're all with mm-hmm. Trab's boy mocking Pip a little bit because it's not...
Yeah,
I think it goes back to that thing that David doesn't have guile. He also doesn't have vice in him. And there are very few readers, if any, who will read the early parts of Great Expectations and not become frustrated with Pip specifically because of his ingratitude and ungraciousness to Joe. It's very hard mm-hmm. to get past that and to be as forgiving as Joe is.
That you have this incredible friendship and kinship that is offered to him, even fatherly role that, you know, Joe steps in and it almost, you can read it so that you can see that he marries Mrs. Gargery in order to be a father figure for Pip, that he sees Pip and says, yes, there's room for him in my forge, that he yeah. has this outgoing earnestness to want to be there for Pip. And they're sort of both held under the thumb of Mrs. Gargery. But so they're on some level, they're also at an equals as well. They're sort of brothers and father-son relationship, but that he's so good and so decent. And Pip is just so dismissive of him and embarrassed by him. And it's so heartbreaking. You just, yeah, when I was listening to that section, I was just like, oh, Pip, would you ever get over yourself?
Yes, yes. And then he's so fittingly brought to his knees when he realizes not that Miss Havisham has been caring for him, but that he is the beneficiary of the convict. And then notice he's mm-hmm. actually kind to the convict. He not only tries to help the convict escape, yep. but he cares for the convict, even though he has a feeling of yep. repulsion from the convict in a way that he, mm-hmm. beyond what he would have felt for Joe, and more in a more justified sense, because this is a criminal and, you know, it's quite serious to fraternize with him at all. And he doesn't want to receive money from the, anyway. I think in the end, the collapse of his expectations and the fact that he does grow, not on stage, as it were, he goes off to Egypt, to Cairo with his friend, Herbert Pocket, and he 11 years toils in a highly respectable, normal, actually doing your job sort of way, far beyond what he's experienced mm-hmm. before. That's almost secondary to what Dickens cares about. What Dickens cares about is that yep. flipping, as you said, the flipping of the heroic trajectory.
Yeah. And that it's almost like Pip has to become a hero in spite of going in exactly the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. I'll have at least one more Chesterton quote on this, which is that when he sets out to describe Pip's great expectations, he does not set out, as in a fairy tale, with the idea that these great expectations will be fulfilled. He sets out from the first with the idea that these great expectations will be disappointing. We might very well, as I have remarked elsewhere, apply to all Dickens's books the title Great Expectations. All his books are full of an airy yet ardent expectation of everything, of the next person who shall happen to speak, of the next chimney that shall happen to smoke, of the next event, of the next ecstasy, of the next fulfillment of any eager human fancy. All his books might be called Great Expectations, but the only one to which he gave the name, Great Expectations, was the only book in which the expectation was never realized. And I think that so sums up what is actually quite interesting about it as a novel, which is this kind of the offering and actually it being the taking away, that so much of Dickens is about action, like we're saying, and succeeding and finding out what the forward momentum is. Like, that's what I love about so much of Dickens's writing, is that sense of momentum, that you're moving forward in a story, and so many different stories and so many different things are happening. Whereas I noticed it in, it was the most recent Dickens book that I read, which is that I was like, there's so much fewer plot lines in this. Like, it's actually quite, for Dickens, it's quite a concise plot line. There aren't all of these side things happening. There's a couple of them, which I might come to in a minute, but for the most part, it's just one story, and it's a story that's going, like I said, in the wrong direction. And it brings Pip to his lowest and strips away all of his ideas of himself for him to come out of the dust and actually get the right perspective and see the value of the good people in his life, and also to lower himself to be the hero to the person he wants to be the hero least to, which is the convict Magwitch, who he just wants to have absolutely nothing to do with.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the simplicity of the plot is an important note, because it focuses us differently. This is the only finished novel after Great Expectations was Our Mutual Friend, which, when I've taught that, I have to pause, write all the character names up for my students, and then draw all the connecting lines. It becomes this fascinating web, which, by the way, only has one coincidence. Which Dickens, if you look closely, people think he's riddled with coincidences. He's not. He actually is very precise when he uses a coincidence, and it's usually to drive providence home. And in that case, that's definitely the case. You don't need that map to follow Great Expectations. You do, to an extent, to follow David Copperfield, even though they are the most similar. Mm-hmm. They're the only two novels where Dickens used a first-person narration for the entire novel. So they're similar, and they do inspire people to compare. We also have the huge question of the end of Great Expectations, which Dickens wrote one ending before publication. And then at the urging of his friend, the novelist Bulwer Lytton, he rewrote it. And people, of course, we have both. So people will read both. Mm-hmm. In the first, the original, he sees the love of his life, having been through an abusive marriage, remarried, and he never speaks to her, but he sees her. Doesn't actually speak to her. But then when he rewrote it to give a greater satisfaction to the reader, what was published was that he does re-encounter Estella. They have a conversation, and it ends with a really ambiguous conclusion, which he also rewrote, saying something along the lines of, "And I saw no shadow of a future parting from her." But people could read it either way. Does he get the girl? Is this just a sense of catharsis and resolution of a pretty problematic relationship that doesn't require or deserve, you know, marital bliss? And that open question, I think, would have been desired by Dickens, clearly, since he wrote it, but also the fact that it does not have that certainty of the happy married couple around the fire with their 15 children. Like I said, so you're left saying comedy or tragedy, or, as Dickens clearly wanted it, tragicomedy.
And I think, you know, I mentioned one of the side plots there, which is just maybe to have a little extra note, which is, in a lot of what Dickens is writing about, he's writing from his own experience. And like you said, he was this incredible public speaker and reader. He also had experience of acting, being a stage actor. And so there's often a lot of plays and acting and actors in his books. And, you know, you have it in Nicholas Nickleby, where Nicholas joins this theater group. And in some ways, that's again how he becomes the hero, because he starts playing these heroic characters. Like the head of the theater troupe, Mr. Crummell, says, you know, you have the walk of a gentleman. And so he uses this acting to literally step into that role of the heroic gentleman. Whereas by the time you get to Great Expectations, you have Mr. Wopsle, who is this, you know, laughable figure from the countryside, from Pip's childhood out in the middle of nowhere. And he comes to London and decides to make it big as an actor. And it's very, I don't know if any of our listeners have watched Arrested Development, but, you know, it's the Tobias Funke kind of experience of that, where it's this disaster. And it's very much kind of the funnier bits of the novel are the descriptions of him acting and him trying to ingratiate himself into the sort of upper echelons of artistic expression and totally falling short of those aspirations. And I think it's kind of telling that Great Expectations has this subversion of what it looks like to be an actor as not a triumphant heroic thing, but actually it can also look like, you know, you're making a fool of yourself on stage.
Yes, and I love that you brought Dickens in as an actor, because he was a professional actor and acted throughout his life. In fact, for lovers of Tale of Two Cities, the ending of Tale of Two Cities was inspired by a Wilkie Collins' play in which Dickens and his children all performed. So he had this real sense of theater and theatrical engagement and theatrical presentation, but also had a sense, like you said, of the inadequacies of it, of bad performances, of bad actors, and of the unintentional hilarity of even Mr. Wopsle's failed expectations. Because Mr. Wopsle had the expectations of being, the greatest star of the West End, and he's uproariously bad at it. But, you know, it could also mirror Pip acting as a gentleman, Pip's performance.
Yeah.
Even for Trabb's boy, Pip can't.
Yeah.
He wants to be something that he's incapable of being or even pretending to be.
And it's also even contrasted against the character of Mr. Wemmick, who is this, you know, this lawyer. He's working for who's the lawyer in it? What's his name?
It begins with a J. Doesn't it begin with a J?
Jaggers, isn't it?
It's Jaggers. Yes. He has a public persona, and then he has his private persona. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes,
that's splendid.
Right. So, you know, in his work as a, Mr. Wemmick's work as a lawyer, and he has to live up to his employer's very scary reputation. And so he's very severe and very scary. And then as soon as he gets out of work, he sort of turns to Pip and says, so is it time to be a nice person again, and becomes this deeply lovable, deeply felt and moral and principled. And like, and then you see that actually, as much as he pretends that there's a separation between his work life and his personal life, that actually those principles and morals are surprisingly still there. He just has this, you know, public persona for them. And I think that's interesting of how the acting can look different in different ways, that Mr. Wemmick is a successful actor because everyone believes him to be this hardline lawyer, when in reality he's sitting at home with, I love all of the sections of his home with the aged, which is his elderly parent, and just he can't hear you, but just nod at him. He loves a good old nod. There's this real warmth to that family life. It's one of the few examples in the book of like a truly wonderfully warm, happy family life, is this Mr. Wemmick and his soon to be wife and his aged parent in this kind of odd castle moat sort of situation, where he has all of these inventions and all of these levers, and it feels a little bit like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, where they have like the breakfast making machine or something like that. He's in some ways to me the best character of the novel. Every time Mr. Wemmick comes on, I think this guy is great.
Well, and I think that goes back to what we were saying at the very beginning about the things that attract us in Dickens. Because I know I live inside my head. That's plenty of experience of my own echo chamber of interiority. I want to be able to perceive in reality Mr. Wemmick. And I want to be able to capture the beauty of Mr. Wemmick and how comic he is, but also how inspiring he is. And I want to be able to perceive the villainy of various characters, or the complex neurotic needs to be in a gothic novel qualities of Miss Havisham, which I think there's a really strong case for this to be considered in the gothic novel in that genre. Dickens loves to play in that genre. You put Bleak House there as well. He sort of throws things in, elements in, mixing the genres up brilliantly. But I want to perceive all that. I don't just want to be trapped in what's going on in my head, because that echo chamber is a dangerous and a boring place. So going back to the Christianity of Dickens, which, yes, I warn my students all the time, all right, if you're looking for theological precision, you're not going to find it, honestly. They'll say, well, wait a second, he referred to so-and-so dying and becoming an angel. I said, yes, he's not Aquinas. He's a novelist. What is he saying, though, about what it means to be human? And so much of what he's saying about what it means to be deeply human is being able to see how vivid and beautiful and fascinating and entertaining and, you know, heartrending reality is, instead of just being trapped in your own head. So I find reading a Dickens novel liberating, and find my, I knew I, at a younger age, and even now, my soul expanding. I watched with my daughters when we were reading through David Copperfield together about a year and a half ago, I could watch their little souls expanding. I could watch them suffer and struggle and laugh. They laughed uproariously at everything Mr. Micawber said. I thought Mr. Micawber would go over their head. They loved Mr. Micawber. He might have been their favorite character. But that they, watching them and seeing them formed in that way, it does not happen with many novelists. I would say it happens with Austen. It happens with Tolkien. It happens with Dickens. Just some novelists who are able to reach in and just expand their little souls in the language, in the characters, in the plot, every aspect. It's just, as a parent and as a teacher, it's tremendously exciting to witness, and continues to make me a lover of Bowes, which was his childhood nickname.
That's so perfect. Thank you so much. I mean, I feel like that's the perfect conclusion to our discussion. I could keep talking about Dickens all day. I feel like at some point I would love to wrangle a Bleak House episode out of you.
Oh, that would be so much fun.
Let's
do it. And then when you read Our Mutual Friend, we'll do that one too. Or we could just, after you read the passage in Daphne and Son, I want you to read, we could talk about redemptive violence in Dickens, because that's a great thing. Yes, anytime you want a Dickens conversation, I'm there.
Fantastic. And so I guess we've got one last question to ask you, which is, what have you been enjoying at the moment?
At the moment, I have been introducing my daughters to Northanger Abbey, which is another repairing my own lamentable childhood inadequacies. When I first read Northanger, because I did not know anything about the Gothic genre, I felt like I was around someone tremendously intelligent who was being really funny, and I was not in on the joke. It was very intimidating. I was about 12 years old. So in reading it with my daughters, I'm giving them the tools to negotiate it so that they are able to follow how funny it is and how brilliant. So yes, between that and I'm doing class preps for Tale of Two Cities. So I'm in another Dickensian mode. So Dickens and Austen, can't get much better than that.
Right, absolutely. I think I'll say I've been having it. It's been really, I've set myself for Lent. I gave up listening to music, which, I mean, there are some caveats to it. I'm still going to concerts and things like that, but I'm finding it so difficult. I keep saying to myself, why did I pick this? This is awful. But it means that I have more other kinds of listening time. So I'm finally catching up on some of my audiobooks. And my friend Jacob has been begging me to read Wives and Daughters by Elizabeth Gaskell. and I am trying to wheedle him onto the podcast to talk about it. So hopefully that will come very soon. But I am enjoying Wives and Daughters. It's been very interesting. So it's been a long time coming. It's been on my to read list ever since I became friends with Jacob, essentially. So we're going on years at this stage, but I'm finally listening to Wives and Daughters and enjoying it.
That puts me in mind of something interesting. So I taught Austen, Dickens, and Gaskell in a semester. And I found that when we read Austen and Dickens, it was just one selection from each. When we read Austen and Dickens reading aloud, we could just, you could chew on that language. It was so rich. Gaskell still delighted us, but it was a little bit, there was a little bit less substance. So when we read aloud, we ended up talking about characters and behaviors, not language. It was just a really revelatory distinction there. I think Elizabeth Gaskell is fascinating and really a good novelist. But when we speak of her after speaking of the language of Dickens, it's a different dimension.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I can certainly see that. Although I read North and South. I love North and South. I'm predisposed to like it because I already loved the miniseries and I think that helps. But I did really enjoy North and South. But there's been a couple of moments, I will say, in Wives and Daughters where it's been a lot funnier than I expected. Again, always amazed when it turns out these older novelists are actually funny. It always catches me by surprise. And yet it seems to be the case. There's this one scene where the character Dr. Gibson has these medical students in his house and he's just getting frustrated at one of them because he won't say, "Can I help you to some potatoes?" He insists on saying, "May I assist you to the potatoes?" it's such a true to life thing of like getting really annoyed at somebody's like particular expression of something that I very much enjoyed that. And I guess before we sign off, Eleanor, do you want to just talk a little bit about anything that you have coming out or what you would like people to know about you and your work and where you can direct them to?
I have a personal website that has way too long of an address, but it's eleanorborgnicholson.com. And the most exciting thing that I have coming up that is not related to my children or my garden is that my novel, Wake of Malice, will be out in September. That is my Irish Gothic romp, which you have signed off on. It is authentically Irish in spite of my lack of accent. And it was tremendously fun to write. I wrote parts of it with my eldest daughter leaning over my shoulder. She's not quite old enough to read my books yet because she won't read Dracula. And I said, that's the entrance exam is reading Dracula. But she contributed a great deal and laughed. She also said when I've been working on it, I mutter under my breath in a fake Irish accent. So a very bad Irish accent. So she'll come in and say, "Are you working on your book, Mommy? Because you're doing that Irish accent again. It's very bad. I won't do it for you, Rachel. It'd probably be insulting." But that's what I have coming down the line. I think it is gothic, but I actually think it's a comic novel. I've wondered lately if I'm actually a comic novelist trapped in a gothic mode.
Yeah, I certainly enjoyed it. I thought there was a lot of comic moments in it. So yes, I'll be sure to mention it on the podcast again when it does come out. And hopefully we will have you back on again, maybe around that time or shortly afterwards. And we can keep chatting because I feel like you and I can keep chatting always. So this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. Always happy to chat about Dickens, especially with you.
Thank you. And for our listeners, thanks again for listening. And as always, you can find more information about the podcast on my website, rachelsherlock.com. You can sign up to our newsletter there if you want it. And you can find us on social media for Risky Enchantment Podcast. So I try to post some nice pictures and keep Instagram a happy place to be with some nice quotes and some nice posts. But yes, and hopefully we will be back again in another 2 weeks with another episode, and I look forward to talking to you then. Goodbye.
This has been Risking Enchantment. Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter with the handle @SeekingWatson. And you can find out more about me and the podcast at rachelsherlock.com. Thank you and God bless.